Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Agnostic Salvation Hour. This time it's me, Marshall.
And this is Michael.
And today we're doing something a little different. We're doing a episode, kind of a counter-apologetic episode, on a book written by Gary Habermas and Mike Lacona called The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, in which they set out to make an argument for the divinity of Jesus so convincing that non-believers, upon hearing their argument, will feel compelled to convert to Christianity. Reasonably, they feel that if they can prove that the Christian belief in Jesus' resurrection is reasonable and a historically reliable position, then the conversion of the readers of that book is all but assured, which I think is probably a correct assumption, that if you do convince somebody that Jesus actually did rise from the dead, they're probably going to become a Christian if they already weren't. So that's their task. And what we're going to do here is examine their arguments. Now, of course, Mike and I think I'm safe in saying, Mike, that you no longer accept that Jesus rose from the dead and ascended into heaven as a historically reliable statement.
But that's right. You know, I'll say this. I'll concede that this is a miracle and an extremely implausible thing. I mean, I can't prove it, and I can't disprove it, but let's just put it this way. I have my doubts, big time. And you know, to our Christian or non-Christian listeners, you know, we're not intending to disrespect Dr. Habermas and Dr. Lacona. These men are legitimate scholars. They have PhDs, but because they're scholars, I was frankly quite appalled and disappointed at how horrible their arguments were in this book.
Yes, yeah. And I would say that that's just because they're working with the material they have available to them. They're on a fool's errand to try to prove something as absurd as the resurrection, and there's really not the possibility of making a good argument for it, right, or a legitimate argument. Right. But that's what they're trying to do, because, you know, if you're a Christian apologist, you know, if you can't convince somebody that the resurrection happened, then nothing else matters.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they focus on that verse in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ isn't risen, our faith is in vain. So
that's true. Mm-hmm. And they're correct. And that's why they're focusing on that. And I've seen a number of other apologists try to come up with their fancy schmancy arguments for the resurrection. I think this, the one that we're about to review, is probably one of the more popular ones among the Christian community.
Right.
Some that the Christian readers are just absolutely blown away by. They think it's amazing.
I was too back in the day when I was a fundie.
See, and I never heard it until after I left Christianity. And then I started looking for books to kind of really put myself in a position where I was making an informed decision. And as I was reading these type of books, and like Lee Strobel's Case for the Christ, I found myself being kind of shocked by the ineptitude of the arguments they were making, especially Lee Strobel. Oh my God, the arguments he makes are absolutely silly.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's start off by examining why we, as skeptics, or whatever you call yourself, Michael, I would describe myself as a skeptic, why we start from the position now that the resurrection did not happen. And I would say the first reason I reject it as a, off the bat, I start from the position that it didn't happen, for Humean reasons. I am a big fan of methodological naturalism. I believe that any time you have a phenomena where there's a natural explanation, you go with that. I mean, you don't pick a supernatural explanation when a natural explanation for the same event is available. And I think, without a doubt, that the growth of Christianity and the belief in the resurrection of Jesus probably has, almost certainly has a much more probable natural explanation than supernatural. So that's the main reason why I start from the position of skepticism. Now, if I couldn't conceive of a natural explanation, then maybe I would contemplate the possibility that it was, in fact, a miracle. But I don't start from that position. Secondly, and perhaps even more importantly, even if I were open to the possibility of miracles, even if I put miraculous explanation on the same level as supernatural explanation. Did I say that right?
Ah, sounded fine.
Okay. Even if I had no preference over one over the other, I consider them equally valid scientific positions or starting positions. Just a review of the evidence that we have for the resurrection, namely the Gospels, really, really goes a long way to convincing me that somebody was making something up. Because you have grossly contradictory stories. Stories where some include angels, others don't include angels. You have contradictions about who visited the tomb, who didn't visit the tomb, where they met Jesus after his resurrection. Luke says they met him like a mile outside of Jerusalem, and then Jesus rose back into heaven that same day, whereas other Gospels have him rising into heaven or hanging around for a much longer period in Galilee, which is a day's travel to the north.
Right.
More than a day's travel.
Right. Well, and by the way, to answer your question, yes, I definitely consider myself a skeptic, but off the top of my head, another problem is that, what most scholars believe is the earliest gospel is Mark, and the original ending of Mark, according to most manuscripts, has, you know, the women seeing the tomb was empty and being told, I think, by an angel.
No, it was a young man in white.
Oh, okay, you're right. Thank you. Thank you for the correction. A young man in white who told him, he's not here, he is risen. And then it ends, the original ending of Mark, according to the earliest manuscripts, has them saying, it says that they
left
were scared and they did not tell anyone. And it doesn't mention anything about appearances. And then it's then you do see appearances in the other synoptic gospels and the later synoptic gospels, which are the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. And then, of course, John, that didn't come till much later, as most scholars believe. You know, real quick, and this might be not the typical reason why most people doubt the resurrection, but I want to, using the Bible itself, I doubt the resurrection because, I don't want to get too complicated here, but to sum it all up, Jesus was an apocalyptic prophet. He predicted the end of the world in his own generation, the generation of his first followers. And we see the second we see the resurrection linked to the second coming. So to basically sum it up, if Jesus really rose from the dead, where the hell is he? Why didn't he come back in the time frame that he promised? Why did he let the expiration date pass? That no second coming. So.
Well, and not only do they have Jesus saying that in the Gospels, but you also have Saint Paul saying that in his epistles.
Right. He says we will. To sum it all up, to paraphrase 1 Thessalonians 4, Paul says we're going to be up, you know, we're going to be taken up. We're going to experience this. Paul was certain he was going to experience this, and his teachings reflected that. He told people, you know, the time is short. If you're married, act like you're not married. And you see that all over the New Testament are predictions, apocalyptic predictions that either explicitly or implicitly predict that the end of the world would happen in the first century.
Well, exactly. Even the book of Revelations has Jesus telling John that he will be returning soon.
Soon and quickly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so which by any stretch of the imagination, I don't think you could call the 2,000 years that have passed as soon.
Right.
And in fact, that's one of the reasons why beer is better than Jesus. Because you don't have to wait 2,000 years for a second one.
There you go.
I saw that on Facebook not too long ago. I think that was funny.
And real quick, and then, you know, we can move on. But, you know, you see, I can't remember off the top of my head if it's First or Second Peter, and of course it's doubtful that Peter wrote any of those. But in one of those epistles, First or Second Peter, the writer is saying, you know, you guys are mocking us about the second coming not happening, but let me tell you, you know, the Lord said a day is like 1,000 years. So you can start to, that's evidence that, you know, they knew that something went wrong. You know, we got, so
yeah.
Is an attempt at a desperation to explain why this delay is occurring.
Well, yeah, you could tell they're trying to cover their ass even right at that point, because it's clear, like you said, something has gone really weird or wrong, and that was a shock. It was clear that was a shock to a large portion of the Christian community who were getting older and like, I'm going to be dead soon, and time's clicking. You know, my husband died.
Right.
Already, he expected to be part of the resurrection.
Right.
And so, yeah, I agree with you. The fact that his state, he failed in his stated goal is another indication.
It's a red flag.
Yeah.
Red flag.
And I would go ahead and say that another reason that I consider, just start from the position of viewing the belief in the resurrection as absurd, is the bizarreness of the Christian theology that developed to explain why the resurrection was a necessity in the first place. This notion that Jesus had himself tortured and killed as a sacrifice to himself, so he could forgive humanity for the theft of a piece of his magical fruit in the Garden of Eden, is just stupid.
Yes, I would agree.
That is just dumb. And, you know, I can honestly say I never believed in Adam and Eve, even as a devout Catholic.
Yeah.
Which is the luxury that Catholics have that the evangelicals did not.
Yeah.
So.
I doubted it, too, even when I was, I mean, it was definitely hard to believe even when I was a fundy.
I wonder if there's a lot of that doubt among most fundies, because it's so silly. I mean, even among some fundies, even fundies now are learning ways to reject it,
right?
And accepting evolution and still claiming to be fundamentalists and just saying that, you know, our reading of Genesis is a misreading.
Right.
So, all right. What is the argument that Habermas and Lacona present in the case for the resurrection of Jesus? They present their argument in two forms, or what they call the minimal facts approach. And by that, they mean that they're only going to accept evidence that meets two criteria, or minimal facts, as they call them. First, the data are strongly evidenced, and that's their word, are, I think is really should have gone there. I just cut and paste that. And the data are granted by virtually all scholars on the subject, even the skeptical ones. I personally have problems with both of those criteria, because as we'll examine, I don't believe that any of the data that they present is strongly evidenced. And we'll discuss that more later. But then we also have this notion of data that's granted by virtually all scholars on the subject, even the skeptical ones. Now, how is it that we're expected to know this? Habermas claims to have done a massive survey and received 2,000 responses from biblical scholars worldwide on these questions that we're about to review. And he claims that the mass majority of them agree with him on the individual points of data. And thus we should view that as proof that this consensus among the scholarly community is proof that these claims are true. Now, Mike, you and I have talked about some of our objections to that in the past. Namely, my first objection is while Habermas claims to have a list of 2,000 scholars having participated in the survey, he has thus far refused to list the names of the scholars or their answers to the survey.
What is he hiding and why?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. He at one point said that he was waiting until he had enough names or enough respondents, but I think anyone would agree that 2,000 is a significant number.
Sure.
And certainly, if he doesn't have enough names that he feels comfortable releasing them, then he certainly doesn't have enough names to prove that Jesus rose from the dead. So, yeah, you know, we can only speculate as to why he hasn't released those names.
To me, it's a red flag.
It is a red flag, and it's also a situation where in any other context we would reject it. We would reject any argument where the person making the argument refused to reveal the data.
Right.
We would just say, okay, well, get back to me once you're ready to show me the data. I mean, I can't imagine making any major decisions about the nature of reality on data that the individual refuses to reveal. And neither would he, by the way.
Right.
I doubt very seriously that if you went to Gary Habermas and said, hey, I've collected data from all the physicists in the world, and they all agree God doesn't exist, but I'm not going to show you the data. Even if you showed him the data, he would disagree.
Yeah.
But he certainly wouldn't agree. He wouldn't even look at it if you weren't going to reveal the data.
Yeah. No.
So it's an argument that he himself would not accept. And right. I honestly think that we could just reject his entire argument, everything that follows, just based on that alone.
Right.
But again, this would be a very short episode if we did.
Well, you know, and I don't want to sound too negative here, but this seems all too typical of most Christian apologists. They'll use any trick in the book, even if one of those tricks, if that was used by their opponents, they would reject. But as long as it bolsters their cause, hey, you know, anything.
Well, exactly. Well, you agree. And I've heard Bart Ehrman say in a interview once that he did not agree that this consensus was anywhere near as strong as Habermas claims it is.
I believe it.
That he knows. I think he would admit that most biblical scholars are Christians and do believe in the resurrection. But at the same time, he would say that there are enough of us out there who don't agree with that we would make up a sizable minority. Whereas Habermas makes this appear that it's a tiny, insignificant minority.
Yeah.
Not even worth considering. But and as you pointed out, you know, Habermas is promoting a argument that he himself would not himself accept if it were reversed. And a case in point would be the consensus on evolution,
right,
which
right.
is one of the strongest scientific consensuses out there. The PhDs in the relevant fields of study, chemistry, biology, paleontology, all that stuff, it's over a 99% consensus among the PhDs. And you got a couple of creationist lunatics who managed to get their PhD here and there. But they're a tiny, tiny, insignificant minority.
Yeah.
But Habermas and Lacona are both creationist.
Right.
And reject that massive, massive consensus. So there's another instance where they're presenting an argument where they expect us to accept it, when reversed, they wouldn't accept it themselves.
Right. You know, and this is, it's so inconsistent, it's not even funny, but our friend Bob Price calls Christian apologists snake oil salesmen. And I used to think that was too harsh, but the more and more I read from these people, I'm starting to think it might not be harsh enough.
Yes. Yeah. Well, because that's essentially what they are. They are salesmen. And he will distinguish them from theologians. He has a respect for theologians who are trying to take either an unbiased approach to the history and the scripture, or they're biased, but they're not claiming any special logical or evidence that doesn't exist.
Right.
But yeah, he's absolutely correct. Apologists are salesmen. Right. And much like a snake oil salesman or a used car salesman, they're going to say what they have to say if it gets you to buy their product.
Exactly.
And as much as we do respect Habermas and Lycona, the same is true of them.
Right.
Even if I believe that deep down they even believe everything they're saying, as opposed to a used car salesman.
Right.
But ultimately, I don't see how they believe it, I guess. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So those are our objections to their methods. And again, you know, if an apologist, an Islamic apologist, used the same tactic to prove the validity of the Quran,
mm-hmm.
you know, if he polled 2,000 Quranic scholars and came up with similar results, Habermas and Lacona, I guarantee you, would not convert to Islam.
There's no doubt about it, right? I have no doubt that they would not.
Yes. So they are expecting us to buy an argument that they would not. So let's move on. We're going to review the minimal facts. And we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on setup. They're just five individual facts that they agree that individually prove nothing. But taken together, serve as a solid indication that the resurrection was, in fact, a historical event. We'll review that fact by fact.
You know, real quick, and I don't want to get us too much on a tangent, but you know, someone rising from the dead—that's so implausible. I mean, if you think about it logically, how could the most implausible? These guys are basically trying to tell us that the most implausible thing, the mm-hmm. most implausible thing, is the most plausible thing. It just doesn't work. Doesn't work that way.
Well, yeah, and they'll even go so far, I think they go so far in this book to point out that there's no way that this could have been, you know, he was near death and then just recovered while in the tomb and walked out, you know, which is perhaps the only plausible natural explanation to him having been crucified and came back. But you're absolutely correct. 3 days of death and then returning to life and then ascending into heaven. There's no way you can ever argue like they do that that's the most plausible explanation. But that's the case they attempt to make. So let's look at the first fact. Jesus died by crucifixion.
It's not implausible. I mean, that was a popular method of Roman execution.
Yes, many, many people who made enemies with the Roman Empire experienced that form of death in the thousands. But regardless, ultimately, it doesn't matter. If Jesus did exist, and I believe that there was a historical Jesus.
I agree.
If he did exist, then he died. Mm-hmm. He died at some point over the course of the past 2,000 years, just like you and I will both die at some point. Right. Whether it was by crucifixion, stoning, alcohol poisoning, mugging, or whatever, Jesus died. And it's inconsequential as to what the mode of death. I mean, even if he had died of alcohol poisoning, he still, it still leaves open the possibility of resurrection, which of course really isn't a possibility. But the fact that he was crucified makes it no more plausible that he rose from the dead than any other form of death.
Right. A couple of years ago, I heard about a scholar who strongly questioned whether Jesus died by crucifixion. But again, that was just one scholar. I mean, you know, I didn't listen to the interview, mm-hmm. but I have no problem believing that he died by crucifixion. I mean, being that he predicted the end of the world, and you know, the Romans were pretty, when something was perceived as a possible challenge to their authority, they were known to come down on it pretty hard. So again, yeah, I have no problem. There's nothing unbelievable about him being crucified.
Although there are, they even mentioned this in their book, there is evidence that he wasn't crucified, but instead died by stoning. And that's in the Jewish Talmud, where they mention a Yeshua on a number of occasions and describe this Yeshua or Jesus as somewhat a similar character to the Jesus of Christianity.
Okay.
And a lot of Christians view this as a reference to a historical Jesus. But of course, the Jews in the Talmud describe him in completely different terms and in a completely different character. He's kind of a not a likable character, but he wasn't crucified. He was stoned and then hung, which I didn't understand at first, but then I looked it up, and apparently the Jews, after they would kill a person, they would hang him on a tree to be publicly viewed. I hadn't heard that before, but I've seen that mentioned in a couple places since my research. So yeah, I guess it is possible that there was a Jesus and he did not die of crucifixion. And there is some evidence out there that that's the case. Regardless, it doesn't matter.
Right.
He's dead.
Yeah.
He died. And really just does nothing to prove their case or disprove
right.
their case. So let's move on to the second minimal fact. Jesus' disciples believe that he rose and appeared to them. Yeah,
this is problems with this one. Yeah, this is problematic for a number of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have little to nothing written by Jesus' immediate followers, at least the ones that are spoken of in the Gospels. The four Gospels were written anonymously,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Greek, so they're written by anyone in Jesus' inner circle. You know, the Gospel of Matthew, it's very doubtful that it was written by Matthew, the tax collector.
Yeah.
You know, these were given their names, and the same for the other three Gospels. They were given their names later. You know, the as we just said earlier, the two letters of Peter in the New Testament, it's very doubtful that was written by the actual Peter. I mean, Peter most likely was illiterate. It's highly doubtful that he spoke Greek, especially the Greek, the formalized Greek that those letters attributed to Peter are written in. And yeah, so it's very doubtful that those were written by Peter. You know, again, Paul, of course, you know, Paul wrote most of the letters that are attributed to him. I'm not convinced that he wrote all the letters attributed to him. However, Paul is, at least according to the Gospels, obviously, we don't read about Paul. Paul wasn't part of the original inner circle. Paul came on the scene later. Although, you know, Paul's letters were written, you know, before the Gospels.
But yeah. That's
another discussion.
Yes. And they make very little reference to Jesus and or the disciples.
Right. And real quick, and in that, there's at least one part in the case for the resurrection of Jesus where Lacona or Habermas just take it for granted that Matthew wrote Matthew. And that's not, I mean, that's very doubtful. That is quite an assumption for them to make. And it's, you know, the evidence is that Matthew didn't write Matthew. We don't know who wrote Matthew.
Yeah, Matthew, it was that the gospel that we call Matthew today was not attributed to Matthew until around 185 AD by Irenaeus, who was one of the church fathers. Before then, there was no indication that any of the four canonical gospels had been attributed to anyone.
Right.
Although some indicate, now I think John was. I've heard that John was, but the Luke and Mark certainly were not.
Well, yeah, I mean, John, but even the Gospel of John, there's no indication. I mean, the author doesn't identify.
No, the Gospel seems to be in the front and towards the back, refer to the person who wrote this Gospel and as Jesus' beloved disciples. But yeah, there's no reference to an actual figure, and there's no reason to believe that John wrote that. It was the tradition back, you know, actually throughout the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, and 5th, and 6th century to write something and then attribute what you had written to someone who was part of Jesus' inner circle or Paul's inner circle. Otherwise, no one would care.
Right.
Nobody wanted to read the gospel of Tom. Tom from 4th century AD, you know.
Yeah.
But people did want to read the gospel of Nicodemus, who was an associate of St. Paul, you know, and that's why they did that. But you're right. None of the four gospels, canonical gospels, appear to have been written by the people that they're attributed to.
Right.
And whether the Irenaeus believed that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, or they were just his favorite gospels and he knew he had to give them some sort of high-ranking attribution, we don't know.
Right.
So anyway, you're right. We have no knowledge. So when it comes to whether or not the disciples believed that Jesus rose and appeared to them, says who? You know, certainly we don't get this from the disciples themselves.
No.
We might not even get this from people who knew the disciples personally. This might be third or fourth hand information.
Yeah. So we're not saying that they did not believe Jesus rose from the dead. I mean, we're not saying that for sure. We can't say anything for sure. We don't. All we have. You know, we don't have first-hand sources from them. All we, at best, second or third hand. I mean, that's where the evidence goes.
Correct.
Or leads. Correct. That's a conclusion the evidence leads to.
Habermas and Lacona go on to say that the disciples were radically transformed from fearfully cowardly individuals to bold proclaimers of the gospel. Again,
martyrdom, right?
Yes. Again, how do we know this? We have very little information on any of the disciples. Now, most people do think that Peter was executed, martyred. Mm-hmm. But we have almost no information on the other disciples, or even a reliable reason to believe that there were 12 disciples.
You know, but here too, we see Lacona and Habermas using tactics that they would reject if someone else use those very same tactics, and I'll tell you why. At a part in the book, there's a part of the book where they talk about the reliability of sources, and they say good sources tend to be unbiased. They tend to be eyewitnesses, and you know, if something comes from a source that's unlikely to make the stuff up, that makes it also reliable. Now, the sources that we have, you know, as far as I know, and I welcome any correction from our listeners, but the sources that I know of about the martyrdom of the original martyrdoms of the original followers of Jesus, they're Christian sources, and it's very doubtful that these people were eyewitnesses of these martyrdoms. So again, this is an example of Habermas and Lacona not being consistent. Mm-hmm. It's inconsistent. It's the epitome of inconsistency.
Well, yes, and also if it were written that the followers of Muhammad honestly believed that Muhammad had ascended into heaven, according to tradition, which is what happened according to tradition, they wouldn't accept that as evidence of anything.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Just a biased, dishonest account of something that they want us to believe.
Right.
But what makes this even more remarkable about how the disciples were radically transformed from fearful, cowardly individuals to bold proclaimers of the gospel is, how was it that they were fearful, cowardly individuals in the first place? That Gospels make it clear. I think the Gospel of Mark by itself has Jesus telling the disciples on three different occasions, they're going to capture me, they're going to execute me, and on the third day I'm going to come back and rise from the dead. They should have been expecting this. They should have been just proceeding as if this is what they knew was going to happen all along. if the Gospels are accurate.
Right.
They had nothing to fear. I mean, and if the Gospels are accurate, they had seen Jesus commit or perform one amazing miracle after another, including two occasions where he rose people from the dead. These individuals should have been confidently awaiting for Jesus' return. They shouldn't have had an ounce of doubt. If they had just lived the year to 3 years of life with Jesus that the Gospels depict. So it seems unlikely that even if Jesus lived and performed these miracles and rose from the dead, that they would have had anything to be fearful of.
Right. Yeah. And you know, you lead me to one other thing that we should ponder, and it goes back to the apocalypticism we talked about earlier. Now, this is a popular argument. I'm always told, well, how could these people die for a lie?
Yes.
And, you know, there's so many ways to answer that, but again, the apocalypticism comes into mind. We see from so many of the New Testament writings that the early church was apocalyptic. Mm-hmm. These people were certain, the evidence is that they were certain that the world was going to end soon in their lifetime. So, you know, if you're certain that the world could end tomorrow, who knows, maybe it's likely the world will end tomorrow, as they thought. If you're that certain, are you really going to care about your life? I mean, you're probably willing to do all kinds of things that might get you martyred.
Yeah, well, and another thing is even if the disciples and Paul knew that they had made up this resurrection thing, that it was a lie, or that they had just conjured it to aid in their conversion techniques, that doesn't mean that they didn't believe that Jesus wasn't this apocalyptic prophet. It doesn't mean that they didn't have a genuine belief that Jesus was going to return to them. It just might mean that they use some dishonest tactics for the greater good, which I think we see Christians do all the time in this day and age. Well, lying, knowing, you know, in the creationist debates, I've seen really intelligent people say things that use science in a manner that they know is inaccurate. They know they're lying, but ultimately, I think they honestly believe, you know, if I lie, but I'm able to save some souls, it's worth it.
Right.
And I don't agree with it, but I can understand their logic in that. If they honestly believe, oh, my phone's ringing, that a simple, a little lie here and there is going to have a huge advantage. Because, you know, they also thought that they were under the gun, that shit was about to happen.
Right.
Jesus was coming back. It could be 2 seconds from now.
Yeah.
We need to convert people, and we need to do it now. If we have to make up something, then we have to make it up.
Yeah. You know, and another problem in people, you know, apologists and your average lay Christian who wants to evangelize, they'll tell me, well, they died. They'll outright say, or they'll imply that these people died specifically for the resurrection. You know what? It's very possible that these people were martyred. It's not implausible, but we don't know the exact circumstances around their martyrdom. We don't know that they specifically died for the resurrection. And another thing, in Lacona and Habermas bring this up, they talk about the deaths of the followers of the Branch Davidian cult and the People's Temple cult with Jim Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they'll use that as an objection. I mean, what they're basically saying is that, well, people willingly died in those situations. So that shows that people willingly died in those situations. That goes to show you people will willingly die for a lie. Not true. There's evidence that people in both the Branch Davidian and People's Temple situation, there were people who died unwillingly, there were people who did not want to die, who were killed, who were mm-hmm. forced to take the drink the cyanide or tried to escape and were shot. So mm-hmm. how do we know that there were Christian martyrs who, how do we know that all Christian martyrs died willingly? We just don't know.
Well, yeah.
That made sense.
There's a difference between dying for a cause and dying because of a cause. For example, somebody could break into my house and say, "Die, atheist scum," and shoot me. Now, in that situation, I didn't die for atheism, but you could argue that I died because I was an atheist. I might be begging, and I said, I might be pleading with the guy pointing the gun at me. You know, I'll convert to Christianity, just don't shoot me. You know, I wouldn't have died in that situation because of my convictions. It's just because somebody decided to kill me. And the similar thing happened in the Roman Empire. You know, just one day, Nero decided to gather up all the Christians because he was using them. He was, you know, the city was mad at him for some reason. They were accused of having started a major fire in Rome. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. And Nero decided he was going to kill all the Christians living in Rome. You know, Peter and Paul were apparently in Rome at the time. They could have begged for their life. They could have said, "Hey, I'll stop being a Christian. Just don't kill me," for all we know. But they weren't given that option. Just being killed doesn't prove that you died for your convictions.
Exactly. And you mentioned Paul real quick. We have little to nothing that indicates how he died. We do not know how he died. If there is evidence, you know, if our listeners want to send us an email, if they know of evidence, we'd be happy to look at it. But from my study, at least, you know, I can't speak for you, Marshall. I do not know of any solid piece of evidence that indicates how Paul died for sure.
But and also we do have plenty of examples of other individuals who knew that they weren't really the people they claimed to be, but also be willing to die as martyrs. Muhammad was one. He didn't die as a martyr. He wasn't killed, but during his life, if the biographies written about him are true, he risked his life on a number of occasions and was almost killed several times. Why, if he knew he just made that stuff up? You know, would that be viewed as evidence that Islam was true? I don't think so. But Muhammad certainly could have been killed on a number of occasions. The same with Joe Smith, founder of the Mormon faith. Without a doubt, Joe Smith knew he was full of shit. He absolutely knew he was lying. But he did die a martyr's death. He was shot attempting to defend a town that he was the mayor of.
Bad joke time. I once heard the joke that says, if you're going to follow a religion, if you're going to follow a founder of some religion, why would you want to follow some guy with such a boring name like Joe Smith?
Exactly. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like they made him up. Right. But he's actually one of the few religious historical characters that we actually know for a fact lived. We even have photos of him. And then you also have David Koresh. He could have surrendered. Why did he choose to die? I mean, he knew he was going to die. He decided to fight to the death. Why?
Could it also be possible that, you know, Koresh was deluded? I mean, maybe he thought that he was the Messiah. I mean, or whatever he claimed to be. I mean, same for Muhammad. I mean, we won't know for sure, but are these not possibilities?
Yeah, these are examples of people doing the very thing that Habermas and Lacuna claimed that disciples wouldn't have done had Jesus not have actually rose from the dead. So, let's move on. Oh, and you know, another thing to establish, and this is a very common argument that I want to address, in their effort to establish that the belief in the resurrection was a very early belief that they could prove the Christians believed shortly after Jesus' death. Christian apologists always turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3-5, which absolutely drives me crazy. And I don't know how many of our listeners are familiar with that, but they claim it's a creed written by Paul. And the first part of it does kind of sound like a creed, and it reads as, For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and he was buried, and he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, or Peter, then to the 12. And it ends there. And as you heard, it indicates that Paul is saying that he received that information. Now, Habermas and Lacona and many other Christian apologists indicate that who he received that from was obviously another human being, and most likely he received it from Peter and James in the early Christian community in Jerusalem within a year of Jesus' death.
That's quite an assumption, don't you think?
Or within 3 years of Jesus' death, I'm sorry. That is quite an assumption. Even if it's true that Paul is claiming that someone taught him this quote-unquote creed, it's quite an assumption to believe that he learned it in his trip to Jerusalem 3 years after Jesus' death. There's no basis for that assumption. That's pure speculation. But I think it's funny that's only half the paragraph that Peter wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. It goes on to read, after that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me as to one abnormally born. Now, here's where you find some difficulties with believing that this was a early church creed taught to him by St. Peter and James. You wouldn't have anything time-sensitive in a creed, such as 500 brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. That wouldn't make any sense if it was written a year after Jesus' death. You know, it's like, duh. You know, it would make it completely irrelevant 20 years down the road. And then you also wouldn't have a creed written by James or Peter that has St. Paul referring to himself in the first person, as he does when he says, and last of all, he appeared to me also as to one abnormally born.
Right.
It's obviously was not intended as a creed, and it was obviously not something taught to him a couple years after Jesus' death.
I never understood why that's referred to as a creed. I mean, in Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Christ, I can't remember which. Is it Habermas?
It's Habermas.
I always found that very strange.
Well, you know, in that book, Habermas points out as evidence that this was a early writing because it refers to Peter as Cephas. Then somebody apparently pointed out to Habermas that Paul's letters refer to Peter as Cephas on a number of occasions in 1 Corinthians and Galatians. It wasn't that uncommon, and nobody argues that Galatians was written 2 or 3 years after Jesus' death. So he doesn't use that argument anymore. But interestingly, they refer to this as a creed. St. Paul refers to this as his gospel. Uh-huh. And in Galatians chapter 1, he refers to his Gospels. He has this to say, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that the gospel I preach is not of human origin. I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it. Rather, I received it by revelation from Jesus Christ. Then in Galatians 2, he has this to say, then after 14 years, I went up to Jerusalem. 14 years, by the way, I pointed out. Went up to Jerusalem, this time with Barnabas. I took Titus along also. I went in response to a revelation, and meeting privately with those esteemed as leaders, I presented to them the gospel that I preach among the Gentiles. So what this indicates, if you believe what Paul has to say here, is he's clearly saying St. Peter did not teach him this, quote, creed or gospel, as Paul refers to it. And no man taught it to him. He received that gospel directly from Jesus Christ. This is what Paul is saying.
Yeah.
He then goes on to say that not only was it not taught to him by men, he went on to Jerusalem and taught it to them 14 years after he converted to Christianity.
Yeah. And, you know, something that may be relevant to this issue is that in there's evidence from the Book of Galatians, which you just read, that there's evidence that Paul and Peter did not see so eye to eye on what the gospel is. I mean, Christian apologists like to present the image that Peter and Paul were totally unified, but even in the Book of Galatians itself, Paul talks about a dispute he had with Peter. Supposedly Paul, at least according to the Galatians, Paul was upset that Peter did not want to be seen eating with Gentiles. You know, mm-hmm. the dispute Galatians addresses the problem of the Judaizers, people who basically thought Gentiles needed to become Jews in order to become Christians. And so, Peter may have, I'm not saying for sure, but Peter may have been led more in that direction and Paul the other direction. We see evidence that there was a possible dispute. So, mm-hmm. you know, again, Habermas and Lacona, they want to make it out as if these guys were totally unified. And I'm not so sure that was the case.
No. Bart Ehrman and Price would certainly argue that it was not. There seems to have been a lot of division in the early church, and there also seems to, my read, and I think Ehrman and Price would agree, is that the early Christian communities were never intended to be anything more than just radical sects of Judaism, mm-hmm. and that it was never intended to be a new religion. And then it kind of evolved once Peter or Paul got involved, and he kind of redefined it in Asia Minor and Greece.
Well, I'll just say this. The theology in the letters written by Paul, or at least attributed to Paul, they really are very different from a lot of the theology you read in the Synoptic Gospels.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I had that discussion with some Protestant coworkers, is that, you know, You would never guess if all you had read was the Gospels, and then you read what Paul had to say, you would never guess that they were talking about the same religion.
Right.
You know, Jesus is very strong on people having to earn their salvation.
Yeah.
To take action, that they must produce fruit, whereas Paul is just the opposite. You know, Jesus did all the legwork. All you have to do is accept it. And
right.
live a life according to his will. But anyway, as for apologists trying to insist that a belief in the resurrection of Jesus had to have been an early belief, you know, within the first couple of years of Jesus' death, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 really does not provide any evidence in support of that claim. But they'll keep making that argument, even though it's absolutely absurd and totally contradicted by Paul in Galatians, mm-hmm. chapters 1 and 2. And again, like I said, if there is an argument being made, it's that the gospel was taught to them by Paul, not vice versa. So, all right, let's move on to the third minimal fact. The church persecutor Paul was suddenly changed.
You know, I was, just to think in simple terms, I mean, before, you know, I was a hardcore anti-Christian before I became a Christian. And, you know, people would have been amazed by my change from non-Christian to Christian. In fact, people are amazed now that for my change back to being a non-Christian. So just starting off, I mean, someone's miraculous conversion from one mindset to another. Well, I say, is it really miraculous? I mean, it can be called miraculous, but is it really miraculous? I mean, we see contemporary examples of this today, and no one, you know, most people are
exactly.
still skeptical.
Yeah, I'm familiar with a number of situations where hardcore Christians become atheists or hardcore atheists become Christians. I'm familiar with at least one example of a Baptist preacher becoming a Muslim, and other instances of Islamic preachers or clerics becoming Christians. these radical, I'm not going to say it's common. It's not common, but it happens. And it's certainly not proof of anything miraculous. And there's also doubt as to whether or not Paul really was a persecutor of the church. The Acts of the Apostles, which is a dubious book, to say the least.
It's very questionable. I'll just say, at the least.
Yes.
It's extremely questionable. I mean, and again, we have all kinds of recordings of implausible things in there. It reads like a fantasy book. I mean, let's just face it.
Yeah.
The book of the world of the Bible, especially the Book of Acts, it sounds like it comes straight out of one of my favorite movies, which is Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's funny. They got lazy, too, because they tell the story of Peter in the first quarter of the Acts of the Apostles, and they tell almost exactly the same story for Paul. The same miracles, the same preaching upon large crowds, the same escapes from prisons, the same being pursued by the authorities. He just retold the same story for both of them, and then goes on to Paul's imprisonment and trial throughout the Roman Empire, which is by itself absurd. You know, Paul travels throughout the Roman Empire being tried for some minor offense and being passed off from one judge to the other, and eventually he gets an audience with the emperor. I mean, it's just silly. I'm not an expert on Roman law and their judicial system, but I doubt very many people made it all the way to the were able to appeal all the way to the emperor on really minor and silly offenses.
Yeah, that is.
He caused a disturbance in Jerusalem. Was the charge was.
Right.
You know, impossible. But anyway, we're not here to talk about Acts. We'll go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, I just find it strange. You know, we have this spectacular story in Acts of Paul. We read it in the book of Acts, says how Paul was changed. Supposedly he saw a vision and, you know, the road to Damascus. But I don't know. I find it strange that in the letters written by Paul himself, I think in Galatians he says Christ appeared to me, but he doesn't go into detail. Paul himself doesn't say, well, I was on the road to Damascus and I got knocked off my horse and that's how he became a Christian. No, he doesn't explicitly refer to that. Again, I'm not saying that he didn't have this vision. I just find it weird. I know Bob Price, and again, I'm not saying what Bob Price says is gospel by any means, but he brings up an interesting possibility. Bob Price thinks that Acts story may have been borrowed by a tale we read in one of the apocryphal books, and then at least one other story. I don't know.
The Bacchae by Erasmus is the other book, by the way. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just find it kind of weird that Paul doesn't explicitly mention the account of the Damascus Road experience.
Yeah, and you know what's even weirder is the reason he was traveling to Damascus. It's said that he was sent there by the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem to, by himself, to go to Damascus to round up, to find the Christian communities, round them up, and escort them back to Jerusalem for punishment. First of all, he would have had no authority in Damascus to do so. Damascus was not a predominantly Jewish city. Second of all, he was by himself. I don't know, the logistics of it seemed to be somewhat on the impossible side. I don't know how he was going to get the Christian community to travel to Jerusalem with him. I mean, it's just an absurd thing, and it really calls into the question whether or not he really did persecute the church. Because they clearly, in my opinion, made up some details that really make no sense. Maybe make sense to the average Christian who isn't going to put a lot of thought into this. But when you do put into thought and you realize the implausibility of Paul leaving Jerusalem by himself to round up the Christian community in Damascus, it seems kind of silly. So there we have it. I think we both agree that Paul did convert to Christianity. No argument there.
Sure.
In fact, I think I think he redefined Christianity, and the Christianity we know today is largely based upon Paul's direction more so than Jesus's.
I would definitely say that's the case for evangelical Protestant Christianity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Luther kind of set that into motion. So, fourth fact. This one's really silly. The skeptic James, brother Jesus, was suddenly changed. This is kind of a repeat of the third fact. Go ahead.
It's debatable. It's not guaranteed that James was a skeptic. In fact, James McGrath, who is a Christian, I mean, he's definitely what would be called a liberal Christian. He probably would be considered a Christian by Habermas and Lacona, but, you know, and I had a correspondence with him, and, you know, to read from an email he sent to me, here it is. It says, this is not my words, this is the words of James McGrath.
And what's his position again?
He's a professor of religious studies at Butler University in Indianapolis.
Oh, okay. Excellent basketball team at Butler.
Right. Of course, they kind of disgraced themselves in the last year's national championship.
Yeah, they did.
Impressive getting there 2 years in a row, but gosh, that was one of the worst performances I've ever seen. Anyway, okay, I'll shut up about basketball. Anyway, words of James McGrath. He says, We don't actually know for certain that James was a skeptic. Jesus talks about dividing families against themselves, and there's no reason to assume that every member of his family was unsupportive of his aims. Seemingly in favor of this possibility is the reference in an early Christian source to James fasting after the crucifixion, having sworn not to eat until he had seen the risen Jesus. There's no reason to think it is a story about a real event, but it does seem to reflect the view that James was something other than a skeptic. So, yeah, I, you know, that's an interesting thing to ponder. I would definitely be interested in identifying the source of which Dr. McGrath speaks, but it's, you know, I'll have to find that, and I can maybe get back to you on that.
Well, there's also, I think it's the Gospel of the Hebrews, that actually has James, the brother of Jesus, at the Last Supper with Jesus.
You're talking about the Gospel of the Hebrews, not the Hebrews and the New, not the canonical.
No, the Gospel of the Hebrews, which was an apocryphal, written in the early first century or second century, never entered into the canon. I think it may have been, no, it wasn't Gnostic, but it was used by the Jewish community in Jerusalem. Or the Jewish Christian community in Jerusalem and Alexandria, but it had James there at the Last Supper. So there are conflicting accounts as to whether or not James was a believer. Now even in the canonical Gospels, Mark and John, you know, they indicate that James at some point during his ministry, at Jesus' ministry, was not a believer. Doesn't indicate that he couldn't have been convinced by his brother shortly thereafter.
Right.
Really, this is a very weak argument. And certainly you cannot go from not believing in the resurrection to hearing that James converted to Christianity and thinking, well, obviously Jesus must have risen from the dead. That's the only possible explanation. I mean, because it's just not. And that's just an absurd jump that they're expecting us to take here.
Right. Oh, and, you know, we were talking about James. Again, you know, if anyone wants to, I don't say how you could do it, but in case anyone's desperate and they want to say, well, we know some information about James, and we have a letter written by him in the New Testament. Again, that it's highly probable that the book of James was not written by the actual James, you know, we're speaking of. Again, that was written in Greek. It's very doubtful that the historical James spoke or wrote Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And
was a very common name,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Much like today. Not an unusual name. I don't think it even refers to him being James, the brother of,
right,
of
that's
Jesus.
True.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we have very little knowledge about James, the brother of Jesus, and the canonical Gospels provide us with almost nothing. Other Gospels that are not canonical. Give us a little bit more information that kind of indicate that he wasn't a skeptic, as Habermas and Lacuna indicate. But even if he was, even if he did convert after the death, you can't accept that and make the leap to the truth of the resurrection. I mean, that's just too far of a leap to me. So anyway, rejected. All right, the final and possibly the silliest one, and we'll try to wrap this up quickly, the empty tomb. How, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, how come there was an empty tomb?
And a funny line by our friend Bob Price comes to mind once again. You know, basically, to sum it up, I mean, to say that the empty tomb is actual evidence, that's like saying that the wizard, that the Land of Oz,
or the Golden Brick Road.
You can explain better than I.
Yeah, to say that the empty tomb proves that the Jesus rose from the dead is like saying that the Golden Brick Road proves the existence of the City of Oz.
Right.
You know, they're both part of the same myth.
Right.
You can't use one portion of a myth to prove the other portion of the myth.
Exactly.
You can't say, if Hercules didn't really exist, then how did he lift that giant boulder? You know, he didn't. There was no boulder, you know, and there was no, there. I, my personal opinion is there was no tomb.
Right.
It's attributed, it said that the tomb belonged to a Joseph of Arimathea, who donated the tomb to Jesus because he was a Pharisee or was a Sadducee. I can't remember.
I think a Pharisee.
And he converted to, he was a follower of Jesus, and he donated the tomb. But an interesting thing about Joseph of Arimathea, I think he was just a made-up character, because there is no historical record anywhere of a city or a town or a village or hamlet called Arimathea. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows historically of an Arimathea. Mm-hmm. And Joseph of Arimathea means Joseph from the city of Arimathea. No one's ever heard of it. And if I remember correctly, I don't remember the exact meaning, but Arimathea translated means something like disciple or of God. I can't remember what it means. But it has a meaning significant that sounds more like a title, you know, that would only make sense in the context of a myth.
Right.
Could be wrong.
Yeah.
Could be wrong. Maybe this town of Arimathea just completely vanished and left no trace. I guess that's possible.
Right. You know, and I'm thinking of two problems. I mean, Jesus was executed as a common criminal. I mean, it might have been more likely that he was put in a tomb. You know, like, unfortunately, we hear about discoveries of mass graves today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not an expert on this. I'd welcome correction by any of our listeners. But it might have been more likely that he was put into a mass tomb, a tomb with several people in it. I don't know. I have to do more research on this. And another thing, though, you know, the land today that's presently known as Israel/Palestine, no one knows for sure what tomb it was that
exactly
Jesus was buried in. I mean, a common apologetic line is that apologists and lay Christians like to use is say, "If he's still dead, where's the body?"
And their argument is if you had Christians running around Jerusalem claiming that he rose from the dead, then the Jews would have cracked open his tomb and paraded his corpse around town saying, "See, he's still dead." But that takes in, assumes a couple of things. It assumes that the Christian community was claiming that Jesus rose from the dead within a year of his death, which was probably not the case. It's very probable, in my opinion, that they didn't start saying that until 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years after he died, that it was a development, a mythical development. And by that time, Jesus' body would have been, you know, desiccated. You wouldn't have recognized it. Second of all, it assumes that the Jewish community really were so desperate to prove that Jesus was still dead that they were willing to desecrate a tomb to prove it. And I'm not convinced that that's... First of all, that was a punishable crime in the Roman Empire to mess with a grave. And I can't remember. It was a pretty severely punished crime. I don't think it was necessarily something you were executed for, but you weren't allowed to remove bodies or desecrate graves. And it was a punishable offense. Also assumes that Jesus was even placed in a tomb, and even if Jesus was placed in his tomb, it assumes that the disciples didn't eventually move the body to another location. There are so many very natural explanations that don't involve the occurrence of miracles that it's ridiculous.
But, you know, just to, you know, answer that apologetic claim simply, oh, where's the body? You know, if he's dead, where's the body? Well, we don't know for sure where he was buried. You can't go to Israel/Palestine and no one knows for sure beyond a shadow of doubt. No one can say this is where Jesus was buried and the tomb is empty. You can't do that today.
Mm-hmm. No, you can't. Although, the guy who did Terminator, Cameron.
James Cameron.
Yeah, he did. He financed that movie about the tomb of Jesus, where they claim they found it, and his body was still in it, and that's been kind of discredited, I believe. Yeah. But ultimately, whether Jesus was placed in a tomb or not, even if it was empty, doesn't prove shit.
Right.
And it's silly to say that it does. I mean, these are really weak arguments that, again, no Muslims saying, well, here's Muhammad's tomb, and it's empty. You know, therefore, you know, that's not going to convince them, Habermas and Lycona. They're not going to convert to Islam based on something like that. And why would they? They'd be stupid if they did. But they expect us to be stupid to accept these particular arguments, regardless of how many of their undisclosed scholars agree with them. Oh, and they did agree. They did admit that this was the most disputed among the scholars, the 2,000 scholars. This only accepted by 75% of those scholars. So, take that for what it means.
And you know, and I guess we're coming towards the end of our show. I'll, you know, Marsh, I don't want to speak for you. I just speak for myself. You know, to our audience. I'm not saying that I know for sure what happened. I don't know what happened. I mean, even Bart Ehrman will say, you know, we can't know what happened for sure. But a lot of things could have happened. I mean, there's tons of natural explanations there's tons of natural explanations. But to say, again, as we said at the beginning of the podcast, to say that the most implausible thing, such as a resurrection from the dead, is the most plausible thing, that doesn't make sense. That's not very logical to me.
Yeah, and in every situation, the most implausible explanation was the one that they were putting forth as their explanation, that the resurrection actually occurred. In every instance, there is a far more probable natural explanation than it was a miracle.
Right.
And that's where I stand. The book goes on. I think we'll wrap it up here. I just wanted to review these five minimal facts that they are certain prove within a reasonable doubt that the resurrection is a historical fact. And ultimately, when we examine the situation, we have to conclude that their entire argument is based upon the contents of the gospel. So they provide no external evidence to any of this. That everything they present is within the Bible, which, again, they wouldn't accept arguments, evidence found within the Quran to prove other claims found within the Quran. And in the same matter, I'm not going to accept verses in the Bible as evidence for other verses in the Bible. It's just silly. And it's a circular argument when you get right down to it. The Bible is true because the Bible is true, is essentially what they're saying. And I don't buy it. Again, like you said, we weren't there. We don't know what really happened. And, you know, we only scratched the surface of possible explanations. I mean, you could, if you sat down, you could probably come up with thousands of possible explanations, of which the resurrection is just one.
Right.
And almost certainly the least plausible explanation. You know, they go on to mention the fact that some people have claimed that Jesus was actually a space alien. And
has anyone ever used that as an explanation?
Yes, I've actually met a lovely woman who really believed that Jesus was a space alien. And she was actually, she showed up at one of our skeptic meetings. She had an appreciation for science. She loved evolution. But she had some nutty woo-woo beliefs. I mean, and she was just convinced that Jesus was such a great person and that there is no God, so what else is there? He was an alien. Come to bring us his alien goodness.
Wow, man, that's...
I didn't argue with her. I figured, no. Yeah. No.
Yeah. You know, and again, it gets back to how we define history. You know, most historians will say history, and Bart Ehrman says this, and I find him to be a trustworthy source. Ehrman says basically that history is a study of what probably happened. Miracles, by definition, are improbable. So, you know, historians can't claim, they really can't claim miracles happened or did not happen for sure. I mean, then, because again, miracles by definition are improbable. So, yeah. You know, that these guys try to present themselves as historians, but they're not. I mean, they're very upfront. I mean, maybe I guess I'll give them credit for this. I mean, they claim to be historians, but at the same time, they're very upfront that they have an investment in this. I mean, they ask the question, well, is it true that God loves us? Is it true that he sent his son to die on the cross for us and provide salvation for us? And do you really think that the answers that these guys are going to answer no to these questions? And
well, exactly.
And real quick, as Bob Price, and again, to quote our friend Bob Price, he said it's a farce. I mean, that when these apologists try to present themselves as historians, because, you know, could you imagine like a historian talking about Abraham Lincoln and him saying, I'm going to present these historical facts about Abraham Lincoln at the end. Do you want to accept Abraham Lincoln as your Lord and Savior?
Yeah. Or, you know, and another analogy Bob Price uses is that, you know, if he turns on the television and he sees a giant monster attacking Tokyo, he's not going to even doubt for a second that maybe he's watching a real-life event. He's going to assume from the get-go that he's watching a science fiction movie, and then maybe his mind can be changed if given credible evidence to the contrary. But he's not going to start from the assumption, oh my gosh, this is a news report of the destruction of Tokyo by some giant fire-breathing dragon. And that's the kind of same thing we're doing here. We're not going to start from the position that miracles happen, and if we're going to be convinced that a miracle happened, it's going to have to be a situation where it really is the only plausible explanation. And I'm not familiar with any circumstances where God did it really is the best explanation.
Right.
So there we have it. Hopefully our audience has enjoyed our attempt to dismantle the arguments of Habermas and Lycona. Again, two nice, respectful individuals. Especially Lycona. He seems, from what I can tell, a very nice guy.
Lycona, believe it or not, in the last month, he's received some heat from his fellow apologist, Norman Geisler, because Lycona just came out with a new book on what he believes is the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus. But in that book, he supposedly does not take the story of saints rising from the dead. It sounds more like a zombie apocalypse to me. But he, to his credit, like Kona does not necessarily believe that is a historical fact. And Geisler on his website has written not one but two letters to Lycona, asking him to reevaluate his position. And, you know, who knows? It'll be interesting to see how this turns out. But, yeah, Lycona's received some heat from his fellow fundamentalist Christian apologists.
Yeah, yeah. And I found that kind of interesting that a someone who's essentially a fundamentalist himself would describe the zombie apocalypse, and there were a couple other things, as literary devices rather than something meant to be taken as historical facts.
Right.
Because it certainly, they don't present it as an exaggeration or a literary device, as a right. metaphor. I mean, it's described as a historical reality in the Gospel of Matthew. So I think Geisler's correct. If you're going to view Matthew as a historical document, there's no reason to view that as basically a metaphor for something else. I mean, what would it be a metaphor of?
Right.
You know, that's the weird thing.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, there's no way you can maintain, if you give a damn about history, there's no way you can maintain a belief in the, you know, as we described it, the zombie apocalypse, because there's no attestation to it in any of the other Gospels or in any other historical document.
Right.
It clearly didn't happen, and you have to be crazy to think that it did.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe that's just some sanity peering through getting into Lacona's skull, which according to Bob Price again, Lacona is actually a very intelligent guy. He just doesn't understand why he remains deluded about some things that are so obvious. So, all right, well, that will wrap up this show. Again, I hope the audience enjoyed it. We might do another one just like this in the future. Hopefully the audio quality is okay. We didn't have any Skype issues this time. So hopefully everybody enjoyed it, and we will talk to you later. Bye.